Welcome to the Texas Crime Cast by the Dallas Morning News. I'm Tristan Hallman. My co-hosts this week are Naomi Martin. Hey, Naomi.
Hi, Tristan.
And Kevin Krause, who are federal courts reporter.
Hey, Tristan.
This week, we'll talk about murder rates and Dallas police staffing. We'll also talk to the Assist the Officer Foundation chairman, Frederick Frazier. They helped Dallas officers during the recent tornadoes that struck Dallas County. And we'll be joined by Alfredo Corchado to talk about the capture of El Chapo Guzman and some news on the Jalisco cartel. We'll also be talking to Kevin on that. We'll end the show today with editorial writer Mike Hashimoto's thoughts on the 20th anniversary of Amber Hagerman's abduction in Arlington. That's what started the Amber Alert. But first, Naomi, let's talk about those murder rates. Dallas came off a historic low rate in 2014. 2015, like many sequels, wasn't quite as good. Could you tell us a little bit about what happened?
So basically, in 2014 was the lowest murder rate since 1930 in Dallas. And so that was big news. And the chief has been touting that for the last year. In 2015, wasn't as good, like you said, jumped about 17%. There were 136 people murdered in Dallas in 2015. And it actually brings Dallas that increase is in line with a lot of other big cities nationwide. And, you know, so we're looking at just the 12 largest cities in the country. We're around like number four, according to like these preliminary numbers that we got. So you have Chicago, Philadelphia, and Houston above us. But we're still like among the highest murder rates for these largest cities in the country. And so it's something that criminologists say at Dallas should be trying to attack, even though we're doing well for our own history. We're not doing that well nationwide for the cities that are comparable to us. So it's something that Dallas needs to keep an eye on. And the police are trying to fight back, but it's an ongoing battle.
And to specify, murder rate actually is not the raw number of murders. So we had, 136 last year? I think it was a difference of about 20 from the year before. So the rate is that number divided by the population. Obviously, still the rarest crime. What was the reason, if any, that police gave you for, I guess, the slight uptick?
So Chief Brown really refused to speculate on why it went up. He was saying that he thinks the story to him was that we are at a historic low for the city. And so he was saying that the credit goes to the police. But the no one is really able to say what makes the murder rate go up and down so much. There were some speculations that it could have to do with the growing population in Dallas or the ongoing drug warfare. There was one criminologist who just said, it could have to do with the education and poverty and other social issues that police really have no control over. So like I said, there are other cities that also had about 15% increase in their murder rates. And so it's something that is going on nationwide, and it's kind of unclear why. But at the same time, it's like the Dallas police say that a lot of their murders are due to arguments and due to drugs. And they're not really due to gangs as much as in other cities. So it makes it a little harder to prevent. For example, in New Orleans, where I used to work, the police there were tackling murders based on gangs, and they had about over 500 gang members identified, and they were going to them and trying to intervene before they were retaliating. Here it seems a little harder to do because the police are saying that they don't really have such gangs, and they don't have these identified people who are going to shoot each other as predictably as in other cities.
So it's still pretty rare, isn't it, that you're going to be killed by someone you don't know, a stranger?
Yeah, and actually most of the murders were among people who knew each other and either acquaintances or in a relationship or friends or family members. There were a few that were siblings or parents or son or daughter.
That's, murder is still the rarest crime, and it's probably one of the hardest to prevent for that reason. Some of the stranger murders, those tend to make news. I don't know how you would classify exactly the Kendra Hatcher, the dentist who was killed. She was killed by a stranger, but the police say it was a hit arranged by another stranger who happened to know her because she was dating her ex-boyfriend. I know that's a lot of pronouns there. Well, it was a love triangle. We'll go with that.
But, yeah.
Is there anything that alarms police about this? I mean, it does seem to be in line with regular, you know, the rates of the last couple of years. And if anything, 2014 now looks like an anomaly. But we're nowhere near Baltimore, you know, which had 300 murders and half the population of Dallas. Is there any cause for alarm here?
I think not yet, but if it continues to go up next year and the year after, that would definitely be a cause for alarm. I mean, it's so hard to compare because, like you said, there are so few of them that a small increase can really be a large jump. But I think that the city should just keep an eye on it. And if it does, I mean, there are still neighborhoods in Dallas that are disproportionately affected by murders, and you have areas in the city that have seen, you know, 10 or 15 murders within a few months. Even just so far this year, we've had, I believe, 3 or 4 in Redbird alone, which is a pretty small area. So there are families and neighborhoods out there that are disproportionately affected, and it can feel like the city as a whole is doing well when these areas are suffering more. And so I think that's something to keep in mind too.
Now, broader issues of crime, violent crime was up in Dallas in addition to the murder rate. Aggravated assault and robberies really have been kind of trending back up the last couple of years, with the exception of a dip in robbery last year. What we heard a little bit about arguing over staffing models, violent crime rates, response times on Monday. Could you tell us a little bit about how the public safety meeting went, where the chief had to answer these questions from city council members?
Yeah, so the chief was saying that this was a record low year for violent crime in the city. If you compare Dallas to its previous years, not necessarily a record, but among the lowest years for violent crime. But the truth is that we are actually on an uptick. There was about a 7% increase in violent crime last year, and it's a pretty there was like 9,000 or so victims of violent crime, and so when you look at those numbers, I think some of the city council members were concerned. And then to add to that, the 911 response times are getting slower, and they were the slowest last year that they were in a decade. So Chief Brown had to answer some tough questions from two of the city council members in particular. Philip Kingston mentioned that he believed other cities like El Paso, Austin, and Houston, maybe San Antonio, could have fewer cops per resident, yet still have faster response times and less crime. And the chief was disputing that and said, you know, I don't think your premise is based in fact. And basically the dispute comes down to whether Dallas really does need more cops, like the chief claims, or whether the chief should be able to be doing more with the cops he has. And so it was interesting to see him sort of get challenged for the first time publicly like that in a long time, where the last time he said he needed more cops a few weeks ago, a lot of the city council members were more supportive and sort of like, we'll talk about it, but we're open to it. And now they're sort of like, we don't know if this is true.
Right. It seemed like before, whenever they were talking about it, it's okay, more cops is the answer. You have fewer cops than you did when you started. The city's growing. You know, we're seeing a little bit of an uptick in violent crime. The overall crime rate, according to how Dallas police keep the statistics, was down slightly last year, making it the 12th consecutive year-over-year crime reduction. But that is sort of an open question. These other cities, which, granted, are different, they have different metro areas, they have different poverty rates. You know, San Jose, it's not quite fair, even though they have the same population, to compare it to Dallas, because San Jose is almost like a big suburb of the Bay Area. Even though it has all those people living there, it's not quite the same place. But do you foresee, you know, were you surprised by that? And do you foresee this continuing, this kind of debate?
I think it will continue. The police associations are about to start their negotiations to get a higher salary, and they're looking to get more paid more. They're currently among the lowest paid in the metro area. So, and then next year's budget is coming up in the fall, and that'll be, the negotiations will start on both the salary and how many cops should be budgeted for over the next few months. So I think this is a argument that's going to continue and a debate that's going to rage among the city council members, because they have to keep in mind that they have to fund the libraries, the parks, all these other city services that also require money, and so they're wondering, do we really need to be spending more on police?
All right, let's give Kevin Krause a chance to talk now. Kevin,
yes.
There was some big news about the Jalisco cartel in North Texas recently. Could you tell us a little bit about that story?
Absolutely. The Jalisco New Generation Cartel has been one of Mexico's fastest growing criminal gangs. And they had a cell operating here in the Dallas area. And so the DEA began investigating them in 2012. And that resulted in 13 arrests. 13 defendants have already been convicted, and all but two have been sentenced. And this is interesting because people don't, you know, people read about all the cartel violence south of the border, but they don't realize that they are operating right under our noses here in North Texas. We have the I-35 corridor, which is one of the key drug smuggling routes from Mexico. And the Jalisco cartel had been fighting with the Zetas for control of that corridor. And that's resulted in a lot of violence in Mexico.
We see this, pop up from time to time in local Dallas police reports as these large amount of drugs that are being smuggled, not necessarily us being able to tie it to a cartel specifically, but you have to imagine that there's that influence. Do you see these kinds of filings in federal court very often in Dallas?
Not very often. There are a lot of drug cases, obviously, and you do see in these court filings, you hear about figures in Mexico who obviously are the suppliers, but you rarely hear that they're, you know, operating here in stash houses, and that they're there's high-ranking members of the cartel actually living in the area. And that's that happened here. A top lieutenant of this cartel was living in Dallas and coordinating the drug activities, they were able to crack the case using informants.
And they have, it seems like, sort of like a real estate agent who was sort of living this double life. Can you talk about that guy?
That's right. The real estate agent was pretty key in breaking up this cell. He had been a real estate agent here for about 10 years and has had his license for about 10 years in Texas. And he also apparently was moving drugs into the U.S. and then returning to Mexico with the drug proceeds. And he was actually arrested in 2012 at the border while trying to enter the U.S. with 9 kilograms of methamphetamine hidden in the engine of his pickup truck. And he decided to cooperate with the DEA, and that helped speed along the investigation, and the dominoes began to fall at that stage. He was sentenced in April to almost 6 years in federal prison for his role. He got probably a reduced sentence for his cooperation.
Is it safe to say that he's got a target on his back now that he sort of helped put these guys away?
Yeah, that's unfortunately for him, these cases are all public record. And he was a key part of this. So obviously when you inform against a drug cartel, that puts you in a tenuous situation. And he probably may need to get some sort of assistance when he gets out. There's also the danger of retaliation behind bars. Not so much in this country, but I think it's safe to say, unfortunately for him, that he's probably a marked man right now.
This is another example of, as you mentioned, sort of cartels hiding in plain sight. You also helped cover when they caught these murder suspects for a murder in Southlake, of all places, of a cartel lawyer a few years back. Do you think that there's a lot more cartel activity going on that we don't even hear about?
Oh, I think definitely, absolutely, and the DEA keeps a lot of this under wraps. You don't know really what's going on. They have multiple investigations typically, and they're looking at multiple individuals. Cases are sealed, but the Southlake case was really interesting because that kind of opened a window for us into this. And just it shows us how long their reach can be, that they can actually target someone living in a affluent city like Southlake and do it in broad daylight in the middle of a upscale shopping center. That was really eye-opening for the public as well as law enforcement.
Does it seem like it's a business decision to be less conspicuous than they are in Mexico? Because it seems like in Mexico, it's always these very high-profile, attention-grabbing killings and, you know, stringing up heads and stuff. But here, we don't see that. Does it seem like a strategic decision?
Oh, absolutely. In Mexico, you know, they have a lot of politicians and law enforcement on their payroll. So they can operate with relative impunity often. And here, of course, situation is a lot different. And they realize that that they can be facing lengthy prison terms, and so they're very careful to avoid violence. Number one, and number two, I mean, it's all about making money. They don't, you know, the violence in Mexico is obviously related to control of the smuggling routes. But you know, once they do have control, the goal is to get the drugs here into the U.S. Stealthily and quickly, and basically to make a lot of money. And you don't want to draw attention to yourself when doing so, obviously.
Now joining us on the phone is Alfredo Corchado. He's a longtime Mexico correspondent for the Dallas Morning News, and he is currently the director of the Borderlands program at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University, so a man of many titles. Alfredo, thanks for joining us.
Great to be back with you guys, my family.
We're going to be talking about the latest with the capture of Joaquin El Chapo Guzman. Alfredo, I just wanted to start out asking you that, you know, we've been down this road before. We've seen him in handcuffs before, and lo and behold, he escaped through a tunnel. Do you believe that this time things could be different? What is being done differently this time to ensure that this man is brought to justice?
Well, I think a lot of Mexicans and really people around the world believe and hope that three times is a charm, you know, that they're able to keep him in jail. One of the big jokes in Mexico is whether they will put him on the third floor or maybe the second floor, and it's not just tunnel, but find a way. I mean, make it more difficult. The interesting thing, I think, that came out of this capture is that you hear a very different tone on the part of the Mexican government. I mean, the first time they capture him during the administration of the current president, Enrique Peña Nieto, the word was, you know, no way are we going to send him. You know, it might be 200 years, 300 years before we send him to the United States. Now, I think within hours after his capture, you started hearing Mexican officials talk to reporters privately. I had a talk with the source who said, we just want to get him to the United States as soon as we can. As soon as we can, I think they like to do it within months. But, you know, Chapo Guzman has such an army of very, very wealthy, powerful lawyers, that the process may take a lot longer than people think. I mean, they have to exhaust every legal loophole. I think it's also a political question for the administration. I mean, do you risk keeping Chapo Guzman and risk another humiliation, another embarrassment in front of the world, or do you just get rid of him? And in doing that, you're also sort of admitting to the rest of the world that Mexico does not have a strong enough rule of law to guarantee that he will stay behind bars this time. It's a question, but you know, I think you know, at least the tone right now from the government is we are open to extraditing him. And I think the process has begun. It'll be interesting to see what happens in the next few weeks, next few months.
What has the reaction been in Mexico? I mean, I know people probably have different reactions, but just reading Sean Penn's piece and others that kind of describe him as this, like, do-gooder cartel boss. I mean, is anyone...
Like almost like Robin Hood.
Like, yeah. Robin Hood. Like, is anyone, like, openly upset that he's been arrested again?
You know, I was looking at that very carefully because the last time he was arrested, there were actually protests in some parts of Mexico, regions where they... saw this guy, the Robin Hood figure, and you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of people took to the streets, asking the government, "Why would you do this to this man? He's only trying to help the poor. He's putting electrical poles where the government does not, you know, do that. He's paving roads. He's even paved all these airstrips, obviously for personal reasons. But many people saw that as for the benefit of the communities. I haven't really seen that this time. And either the Chapo Guzman PR campaign is not really working up to snuff, or that the that maybe people just feel like, you know, it's been too much of a distraction. It's been way too much of an embarrassment. The peso has been sliding. This is the Mexican currency sliding against the dollar, and some people even blame that on Chapo Guzman. But I think that the overall sense is, let's try to get beyond this, and let's try to, you know, do our part to try to make things better for Mexico. I mean, the current president has 3 years left on the agenda, and his popularity polls have been down. The situation in Mexico has not looked very good recently. So I think people are hoping that that this moment, that they can capitalize on this and actually try to push Mexico forward. That on the other, on your other question about the champagne, there isn't, you know, there has been an outcry among many of my Mexican colleagues. I think a lot of us, when, at least when I first saw the online version, I thought, kudos for Champagne. Wow, this is great. This is fascinating. You know, you get to listen to this man, and the sound of the chickens, the rooster, is invaluable. But then you read through the article, and you start thinking about the sacrifices that our colleagues have made in Mexico, you know, in seeking the truth. And you realize that Champagne had an agreement with Chapo that he would approve the final article, the final story. And there were no follow-up questions. There was no challenging. This is a man responsible for, you know, thousands of deaths throughout the country. You know, 120,000 people have been killed or disappeared in Mexico. And not one question put to him about that. I think in many ways it was really an insult to the colleagues in Mexico.
And you yourself,
and to any journalist.
And you yourself have even gotten death threats and known journalists who died. And I was wondering, like, have you ever even considered letting a cartel read your story before it was published?
That's a great question, Ami. I mean, I wrote a book, Midnight in Mexico. I have worked for many years for the Dallas Morning News on these issues, and there have been at least two, maybe three times when cartel people have reached out to me asking me whether I want to hear their side of the story. And sure, you know, both times I've been very interested, because that is part of the story that you're missing. You know, what do they say? What do they think? And you want to get the other side of the story. But the conditions have always been such. I mean, I remember the last time people reached out to me, I said, look, I have two questions. One is, can this person guarantee my safety? Will I be able to interview, do the interview and come back safely? One, I mean, if this person does not like the story, will we get a letter to the editor, or will it be worse? I mean, are you going to get a death threat? Something, you know, are they going to harm you, et cetera? And the second question was, what are the strings attached? And it's always been, we get the last say-so. Why would I, as a journalist, agree to such conditions? I mean, if you do that, you're basically, it's not very much different from what your colleagues in Mexico face. And by that, I mean, you live under the same kind of censorship. And in doing so, you're only adding to the myth of these narco leaders. You know, they become larger than life. So why would I use my profession as a journalist to try to make them bigger? So yes, I mean, I've had opportunities, but I've always declined that because of those conditions.
Did you expect the reaction that you got after you tweeted about, you know, Sean Penn in sort of the things that you mentioned, your apprehensions about the interview, your criticisms about the interview? Did you expect to get as much attention as you did?
Absolutely not. I mean, I remember I was out that day, came back to the apartment, read about it, and I started sort of tweeting because people were asking me on Twitter, you know, what do you think, what do you make of this? And I said, well, it's Chapo, it's Champagne, it's Hollywood. Of course it makes sense. Just don't call it journalism. And but the more I read and the more I started looking into it, it just made me really feel sick to my stomach. And I remember before I turned the lights down, I went to sleep, I sent that tweet thinking, okay, good night. Wake up in the morning, and it was crazy, the reaction. I don't think I've ever had such a reaction on social media, but it tells you a lot about the power of social media. That little one tweet, I mean, I haven't even counted, but it was just immense. I mean, it was massive.
What do you think El Chapo's capture means for cartels? I mean, is there sort of a fear among them now, or do they still feel like the government doesn't matter and they run the government in Mexico?
As far as, you know, if you're listening to this in the U.S. and you're thinking, is this going to disrupt my flow, as a consumer of illicit drugs from Mexico? No, it's not really going to have much of an impact. I mean, the flow will continue. You have consumers, you have supply. You might see in Mexico in some regions a dispute for the power vacuum in places like, for example, Ciudad Juarez, right along the Texas border, Chihuahua, maybe the state of Sinaloa. Those regions, you know, you may see conflicts, you may see an outbreak as people try to take over Chapo's, even fill Chapo's shoes. But I think overall, Chapo's sort of been on the run or has been inactive as much as he can, because he's still very active in prison. But we haven't really seen much of a change. So I don't expect that to change dramatically, even with this capture.
So what kind of impact for people in Texas? I mean, they see it, it's Mexico's right across the border, obviously, but it still seems like a world away to some people. I mean, what kind of impact does things like this have on just your ordinary person in Texas?
I mean, I would look at regions more along the Texas-Mexico border, where you've, over the last few years, you've had a dispute for power. I mean, places like the South Texas Rio Grande, where the Sinaloa cartel has been working very closely with remnants of the DAF cartel. Places like Laredo, Nuevo Laredo, where the Sinaloa cartel has been trying to muscle in against the Zetas, and obviously the Ciudad Juarez, Chihuahua region. Those borders areas that, you know, right across Texas, I think would be interesting to see. But as we've reported many times, I mean, just about every cartel, Mexican cartel, is in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, the North Texas area, because of geography, because of the distribution. But I don't think you will see that much of a change as far as the flow of drugs in that area. It doesn't really change that much. It changes more on the Mexican side than on the U.S. side.
Alfredo, could you elaborate a little bit more on that, the presence of these cartels in North Texas? We heard earlier about the Jalisco New Generation cartel, the so-called Mata Zetas, the Zeta killers, and the cell that was disrupted here with the arrest of 13 and arrest and conviction of 13 defendants. They seem to be operating very quietly, and you don't see any violence like you do in Mexico. How are they? How is it structured, their presence here in North Texas?
Well, I mean, first of all, I mean, congratulations to you, because I think you were able to. You were one of the first reporters that actually documents the presence of the Jalisco, the Generación Jalisco, in the United States. Which is a big, big deal, because these guys have gotten a lot of attention in Mexico as one of the up-and-coming, if not the most powerful cartel next to the Sinaloa cartel. But I think people, experts, analysts have been waiting to sort of document their presence. I mean, you're not really an international cartel, a big, powerful cartel, until you can document their presence on the U.S. side. So by doing that sort of solidifies their presence. But, you know, I mean, again, that whole area, North Texas, is incredibly, I mean, they lure just about every cartel from Mexico and otherwise into that area, because you can go to Atlanta, you can go to New York, Chicago, et cetera, Canada, for instance. But the way they operate has always been very, very different. I mean, in Mexico, you know, you see bodies hanging from bridges, heads, you know, headless corpses, etc. You're not going to see that on I-35. I mean, that's that. And, you know, there's a whole different change in operations. In Mexico, very weak rule of law. You know, 95% impunity, which means that less than 5% of the cases are ever really tried, or you have some kind of conviction. So it's much more mayhem and much more in disarray. In the United States, the idea is you keep your mouth shut, you keep your head low, you try not to make noise, you try not to tell anyone that you're here, because the outcome is very, very different. I mean, you end up in jail, locked away, and so forth. So it's a very different way of operating on both sides.
All right, Alfredo, one more question before you go. What's your favorite Sean Penn movie?
Richmond High. That's still, I can imagine him. Dude, we got him.
All right, Alfredo, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Take care.
You too.
Thank you.
Now on the line is Frederick Frazier with the Assist the Officer Foundation. Fred, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Fred, could you tell us a little bit about what the Assist the Officer Foundation does?
Well, we were established in 1999, and the reason why we were established was we needed a vehicle to help out officers, primarily Dallas officers, that were in a position of financial need during a time of some catastrophic event, whether it be an injury that has occurred on duty or off duty, or a death. And when we started it, that's how it started. And we've changed it to fire personnel as well. And we've gone outside of Dallas to include other officers in the immediate metroplex.
And y'all have been doing some work lately with officers who lost their homes, is that right, in the tornadoes? Can you talk a little bit about how many officers lost their homes and what happened to them?
Well, we had six total Dallas officers lose their homes, two retirees that were former Dallas officers on top of those other six, and then we had four Dallas County Sheriff's officers who lost their homes, and then we had one Garland officer lose his home. All in all, we had 32 recipients that were eligible for tornado relief from the money, and this comes from, you know, the damage to their house. Not all of them were complete losses, but excuse me, out of those 32, you know, we had several that had completely lost everything.
Well, you actually went into some of these homes that were destroyed, right?
Yeah, I went. Some of them you could not go into. I toured every person that we gave a check to's property or home, and some of these homes were completely flattened. And how that they survived is a miracle in itself. But the tragedy is, this was the day after Christmas. And it's not like it's ever a good time to get hit by a tornado, but it was the day after Christmas, and we got 5 inches of rain compounded on top of that tornado directly afterwards. So anything that they had to try to salvage was usually was water damaged, and so we had to first find them a place to stay. And I know that everyone's going, well, they have insurance, right? Well, they do, but when you have an incident like this that happens overnight, and this affected thousands of residents from 40 miles long, because our officers that were affected by this were in Ovilla, Red Oak, DeSoto, Sunnyvale, Rowlett, and Garland. So you had a path of destruction where you had individuals that were affected.
Did any of them have any looting happen? I remember seeing reports of that some of the officers had to be guarding their homes against looters.
We did, and for some reason, and I think it was just an oversight of logistics with the police, the policing of, you know, when something like this happens, you have vehicles that are in yards that don't belong there. You have exposed areas of, you know, it's just like, you know, your stuff is laying everywhere. And in some of the facts, the walls are down on these homes. and folks can just walk in. Well, one of our officers in Rowlett, his house, when they went back to check on it, and they didn't, it wasn't secure. That area wasn't secure. Anybody could just drive down the street and take pictures. So it became a easy way for folks to take advantage of them.
A lot of these officers, you know, police officers have to deal with people when they're going through some of the worst moments of their lives. And this is obviously one of the things that you don't expect in law enforcement or life is getting, you know, struck by a tornado and losing everything. How are they still able to, I guess, go out on the streets every day and do their job in light of the fact that some of them don't have a home to go back to?
And that's the tough part when you think about it, especially when you compound that with a family. And they're living in motels right now. So you have officers that are reporting for duty, dealing with citizens, dealing with criminals, the day-to-day functions of police work. And then when they go home, they're not going home. They're going to a motel, and they're waiting basically in a limbo state of the what the insurance is going to do and how they're going to figure out. We have one officer that his house, there. I would tell you right now, it's not salvageable because of the water damage that got inside of it and the two walls that are just they're just basically standing there. He has no ceiling on his house or no roof. And he is in a limbo because they're still waiting on engineers to figure out if they're going to rebuild it or bulldoze it down. So you have situations like that, that their stuff is sitting in storage and they're just living in some motel.
Have you ever had to deal with this before, officers involved in these natural disasters rather than sort of off-duty or on-duty incidents like this?
We have. We had the Lancaster 40 tornadoes a while back, and I think that was an 11. I have to look back at my notes, but I think it's an 11. And that was really our first go-around with when we had a mass of catastrophic event happening in our area with Mother Nature basically relocating officers. That's the first time we did our tornado assistance fund. And I've got the officers from that set, and there was like five. I think it totaled out at the end about eight. And they were like, I can't believe that you guys were there the day after this happened and you helped us get to, that you helped us get back on our feet. And that's the reason we have this foundation. And it's set up for that moment, for us to have a plan of action. When the tornadoes went through that Saturday night, we were all on the phone. We were checking on our officers as our messages were coming in to see what had happened, make sure that we didn't have any deaths or injuries. And so what we did is we put together the team in the morning, Sunday morning, and we came in and we put a list to go tour these. And some of these officers, we went and toured their location and looked at what they had, and they didn't have anything wrong. So they didn't get anything. But the ones that had the damage and the loss of property, we made sure that we got a check to them that day. We took the checks with us just to be prepared to get them on their feet and get them into a motel. And some we met at motels and got the motels established for them to go right in.
Are you still accepting donations for these officers?
We are, but to be perfectly honest, we raised $144,096 in 6 days, and we've dispersed every penny of that as of Tuesday. We had the last set of folks come in, and I'm telling you, the look on these guys' face when you hand them a check, knowing that the citizens and the public stepped up and their fellow officers said, "Man, I just want to help them." I mean, there's so much loss here because, I mean, you got to imagine you have all your stuff you've collected for all these years, and in an instant, it's gone.
What were their reactions like when they saw the check?
It was very emotional, and it was extremely grateful. We had one of the officers that's down in Ovilla. He gave a speech in front of the membership of what he thought of how we did this and how grateful he was and his family. So it's one of those things. We've done a very good job, and And I got to tell you, Senator Corona came by yesterday, and he donated. He wanted the list of officers that we helped. So what he did is he wrote a whole nother set of checks for all of the recipients that we've helped.
And that's state, so we have, the former state senator, John Corona.
Yep, former state senator John Corona. So now we have those 32 checks that we are going to distribute, and I don't know what the amount is because they're obviously all from his group there. But they just wanted to help out to make sure they've been a long time friend of ATO, and they know the work that we do over here, and they just wanted to help out as well.
Well, that's great. Well, Fred, would you tell people what the website is?
Yeah, if anybody wants to go in there, it's always going. It's our atodallas.org, and that is atodallas.org. You can see the folks that we help there, some of the stories that we've told about officers, and so people know we don't have an administrative cost. Everybody that works at ATO are volunteers. Myself, an officer. The whole board is made up of six working officers and one retiree. The only person here that helps out with it is Tiffany, and she is employed by the Dallas Police Association. So she just kind of volunteers her time on the side to make sure that things go a little bit smoother since we're out in the field working.
So all the money goes toward Dallas or affected officers.
All the money is going to go to law enforcement, or in a case where we have a fireman that's killed, because they get the death benefit. And we've had firemen that have been severely injured, and we've had specified monies come in for that fireman, and then we've helped with that.
Gotcha. Well, Fred, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
All right, take care. We'll turn to Mike Hashimoto for his latest Hashing It Out commentary in just a moment, but that's it for the rest of us today. Thanks for listening, and we hope that you subscribe to our show on iTunes if you haven't already. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're at Texas Crimecast, and you can like our page on Facebook. Thanks again to Frederick Frazier of the Assist the Officer Foundation and Alfredo Corchado for joining us. For my co-hosts Naomi Martin, Kevin Kraus, and our producer and sound engineer Tommy Noel, I'm Tristan Hallman. We hope you stay safe out there. Now we drop the mic.
Sometime in the months or years after Amber Hagerman's abduction and murder, the Arlington police chief told the story of the determined reporter. She told him, quote, "I'm going to call you every day until you catch this killer." That chief would move on to another job running the Dallas police and then retire and run for mayor. On Wednesday of this week, we marked the 20th year since that awful crime. It's safe to say that reporter stopped calling. She might be a grandma by now. Few crimes grab our attention the way this one did. Amber was 9 on January 13, 1996, riding her bike outside an abandoned supermarket. Her body was found days later in a drainage ditch a few miles away. It was one of the first 24/7 cable news crimes, wall to wall, day after day. Police have investigated 8,000 tips and today are no closer to closing the case. One theory was that the killer was a drifter who drove the much-spotted black pickup truck straight out of town, never to be seen again. We may never know. But as retired and current detectives showed this week in Arlington, we can never stop trying.